So 2 weeks ago, we celebrated the 60th anniversary of the mass conversions to Buddhism in India, which we sometimes referred to as the Dharma Revolution. Dr. Ambedkar, incredibly inspiring man, who is a member of the Dalit community, what used to be called, rather appallingly, and were treated as untouchable. He led thousands upon thousands of his followers out of what's known as the hell of caste, through leaving behind a system in Hinduism that treated them as less than human, less valuable, less pure than cattle, literally. Through his legal work, through creating the Indian constitution at independence, he enabled the outlawing of caste, made it possible for his followers, the Dalits, so-called untouchables, to receive education, have quotas for decent jobs that were not just refuse clearing, rag picking, sewage moving, and so on, enabled them to develop self-confidence and self-respect. But also, more particularly, perhaps he also set up conditions for them to practice the Dharma, meaning they don't just have to be content with just a materially better job, but have deeper sources of worth and value and can move towards enlightenment. But the Dharma Revolution is not just limited to India. You know, the theme of this whole year on the Saturday mornings has been the transformation of self and world. And we've been exploring that in different ways. Most recently, looking at the puja, and that's sort of something that's still continuing. And obviously, we're doing the literal transformation of the shrine room, but that's not quite what we mean by the transformation of self and world. We're all trying to move beyond the so-called poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, to make that paradigm shift to seeing things as they really are, in the sort of traditional Buddhist terminology. Impermanence, insubstantiality, that sort of lack of sort of fixed inherent selfhood, dukkha, the sort of unsatisfactory nature of conditioned existence, and shubha or ashubha, seeing what is not really beautiful as beautiful. So we see things that we think are beautiful, but because they are impermanent, insubstantial, and they are not ultimately satisfied, they are not ultimately beautiful. So we are searching for that deeper beauty that's more lasting in enlightenment and in sorts of creative, skillful responses to life. The two main issues that I thought of initially. Firstly, well, we pay lip service to acknowledging impermanence and dukkha. We say, oh yeah, everything ends, life's a beach and then you die, whatever it is. But do we really see it? Do we really take it on board? Do we really want to see it like that? We're attached to our comforts and our pleasures. We like them. We're reluctant to let them go. Because who knows whether something pleasant, better, will actually emerge. It's like we're sort of stuck into holding on to what has worked in the past. And the second thing is, well, Buddhism has become better known in the West since Sangharakshita established our order and movement in the 1960s. There are many more Buddhist traditions over here now, as well as Hinduism and so on being much more visible, more better known. All sorts of things that people can try and do and experiment with that they might not have been able to be aware of, sort of 30, 40, 50 years ago or so. More people are learning about meditation and yoga. It's no longer a fringe activity. And on the plus side, mindfulness in particular has been taken up by health professionals in a completely secular context to help with anxiety and depression and pain management. And people associate images of the Buddha with calm and tranquility. generally that's a really good thing. You know, how can it not be? It can be really helpful for people. However, because it's become so popular, there's a big risk of Buddhism becoming assimilated into Western culture without us realising it. You know, stone Buddha figures are now the ornament of choice to put by a pond rather than the garden gnome. You know, I'm sort of being slightly hyperbolic, but that is the case. You know, the number of images that we sell in the shop here, you know, they're because people like the look of them. And, you know, people could associate mindfulness with illness. It's what you do when you're stressed, rather than seeing it as a step on the path towards complete freedom from suffering. Metta and mindfulness are really important practices, as we know. They're often what gets us through the door of the Buddhist centre. But to practice them in their fullness, to really bring about a Dharma revolution in the West, we need to examine our assumptions and our views extremely clearly and extremely closely. We know in theory about impermanence and dukkha, that we're caught up on the wheel of life, but to fully break free of ignorance, we need to understand the specifics of what we believe and think and talk about, and not just take it in terms of the generalities. There's a particular sutta, text, said to have been spoken by a teaching given by the Buddha called the Dasadhamma Sutta. It's 10 things that should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. In other words, one who's trying to practice the spiritual life, trying to gain enlightenment. And one of these 10 things, to quote, "I no longer live according to worldly aims and values. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth." Another translation is, "My behaviour should be different from that of householders." Now then, as well as Pranyaparamita and the Buddha, we've got four images on the shrine. They're the four great kings. They'll have a part to play in the ritual later this afternoon, but they're actually relevant to the theme of this talk, so I was going to say a little bit about them. They're what are known as Lokapalas, protectors of the world, according to Indian mythology. They're part of the lowest tier of the god realms, and so they're in touch, so they're divine, they're heavenly, but they're also close enough to sort of the realm, as it were, that we live on, that they can have an influence. So they, you know, they participate in both worldly and heavenly energies, if you like. So they can intervene in worldly affairs in a beneficial way. I should say this is myth rather than, you know, true inherent, you know, sort of literal existence. But yeah, this is the spirit. In the Sutra of Golden Light, they promise to protect the monks who recite the sutra. In other words, the people who are teaching the Dharma. And they will protect the kings who support the monks. So how do they do this? Well, a temple, you know, or a shrine room, if you like, is a mandala, a harmonious arrangement of psychological, spiritual, and transcendental energies around a common central principle, the principle of enlightenment. You know, I'm quoting here from Sangharakshita's book on the Sutra of Golden Light, Transforming Self and World. So, you know, and you tend to see images of the kings on either side of the doors to a temple in places like Tibet. They're the guardians of the four gates of the mandala. They protect against, as Bhante says, all the gross, chaotic, turbulent or unintegrated energies that are hostile to or get in the way of human development or spiritual development. And those energies, and those are the ones that are not prepared to align themselves on their own level or in their own way with the principle of enlightenment. And the kings also let in all those energies that are integrated and able to align with enlightenment. As Bhante says, otherwise the potential richness of the mandala would be diminished. So you could see some of the energies that the kings protect against as being as worldly values that are counter to the spirit of the Dharma. So what are these worldly values? Our families, we, our families, our friends and the society around us have many assumptions which we can find it hard to really see. They're the water we swim in. For example, with politics, our families might vote a particular way. The friends we associate are likely to vote in a particular way, the same way that we do. And we can't imagine how people could possibly vote differently. And I'm just sort of thinking about the American election at the moment. I can't possibly imagine how people could even think about voting for Donald Trump. But he is really popular with a particular section of society. I sincerely hope he doesn't win, but who knows? It's just like, how can people vote for him? But he's obviously speaking to something that I can't see. And so, so examples like this is a sort of relatively superficial, a relatively obvious example of the sort of thing that I'm talking about. And then I'll have more to say about some of the. So what I thought I'd do is explore a few of the sort of values or ideas or opinions that we might have. They're just a sort of list that I sort of jotted down in about 3 minutes a few days ago. So they're not. It's not an exhaustive list. I'll have more to say about some of them than I'll have to say about others. You might agree or disagree with what I'm saying, but I just thought, well, we can use this as a basis for discussion or reflection. I know that I can sometimes be a bit dogmatic. This is how it is, or this is the way I see it, and whatever. But that's actually, in a sense, counter to the spirit of the Dharma. It's like, well, that things might be true, that might be the way things are. But it's like the way we hold things is also, if we hold on to something tightly, that's completely counter to the spirit of the Dharma. So if you're thinking, oh no, she's saying this, bear in mind I might not be saying things in a nuanced way or giving all the necessary caveats. I'm also not setting myself up as having seen through all of these issues myself. I haven't. Unless very definitely still work in progress. But they're issues that I'm aware of, and you might think of others, you might agree or not. So firstly, scientific materialism. This is the belief, or the set of beliefs, connected beliefs, that there is nothing that science cannot prove or solve or discover, and that there's nothing in the universe other than matter, what can be seen, heard, touched, will be discovered by scientific instruments. For example, the view that consciousness is solely a byproduct of neurons firing in the brain, and that there's nothing of you there before you're born, and that you come to an end at death. And so this is as much of a belief, perhaps even as much of a religion, as that there's an eternal soul that goes to an eternal heaven or hell after death. I get the sense that the deeper into science people get, certainly top physicists, top astronomers and so on, actually the more they get the sense of what a mystery life is and how unknowable the universe is. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the scientific method. It's really important. We need to test things out, to have a hypothesis, test it, see whether it's true, refine the hypothesis, see whether that's true, and so on. The Buddha, I couldn't find the quote when I was looking, but apparently the Buddha said something like, "Test my words as a goldsmith tests gold in the fire." So we might take things on trust, on faith initially, for example, the law of karma, conditioned co-production, impermanence, and so on, all the well-known Buddhist teachings. But at some point, we're going to have to see for ourselves if it's true. We've thrown out a creator god and superstition, but let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Be open to the fact that meditative experience is real. There are higher states of consciousness, visionary experiences of the Buddhas or Bodhisattvas that are no less real or meaningful than what we can see with the physical eyes. There's an element to sort of on a slightly different tack. the sort of myth is important in our lives. Story is important, but things might not be literally true in the way that we sort of, you know, there might not be a sort of, you know, sort of a figure of Avalokiteshvara that's a literal embodied being, but the principle is important. It's a wonderful quote by Neil Gaiman, which I think was paraphrasing G.K. Chesterton, which goes something like, "Fairy stories are important, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us dragons can be beaten." So there's a non-literal truth to be found in myth. The myths and stories surrounding the Buddha, that he talked with the devas, the sort of heavenly realm, people in the heavenly realms, that he encountered a being called Mara under the Bodhi tree. Well, they might or might not be literally true. We could never prove it anyway. But they say something important about the process of enlightenment and the process of the spiritual life. Sort of scientific materialism, but that's, I suppose, an aspect of materialism. With materialism can come nihilism. You know, if there's nothing in the world but matter, well, live now because tomorrow you die, sort of thing. And often consumerism. It's like if there's nothing beyond the senses, we might as well enjoy what we can get, and the more we can get, the better. And the more stuff we have, the better. The more worth we have, the more valuable something is. Again, you know, the better. That is sort of, that's one way of judging success. If there's nothing more valuable, or if there's nothing beyond the sort of the material realm. Another possible view we might have, sort of, I haven't quite got a word for it, but I'm just calling it me-ism. The preoccupation with ourselves. A sort of spirituality that's about what feels best for us without reference to other people, either as advisors, so the people have sort of, as it were, been there before, done it before, or taking other people into account with your decisions. Thinking about what I've heard of the early days of the movement back in the 60s and 70s, there was lots of idealism. There was lots of idealism in the wider world. Which we probably can think of, you know, people would throw themselves into things without safety net, just through confidence and trust, and okay, let's just go for it, let's try and change the world. There was a safety net of sorts, the welfare state. You know, it seemed to have much more capacity in those days, or just the policies around the welfare state were much more optimistic. I remember in the 1980s, I went to university and I had a grant, and my parents. I was lucky enough that my parents were able to afford to support me and didn't expect me to get a job to pay for what the grant didn't cover. You know, they gave me the full thing. They didn't expect me to get a job in the summer vacations. As it turned out, I signed on. That might or might not have been a good thing, but it did give me that freedom to explore. I suppose the welfare state of those days, maybe there has also... It's also had consequences. You know, perhaps it's a factor in contributing to how tough things seem to be at the moment. The welfare system, and so on today. It did mean that people were free to follow their ideals. In the 1980s, Thatcher came along, and she said something like, "There is no society." That sort of like that. No, you know, isn't it? You were out for what you could get, you know, that sort of wealth accumulation, and me, you know. Eventually grants were replaced by student loans. It became much harder to sign on, which in itself might be a good thing, at least to some extent. But students started having to be much more career-focused or end-result-driven, with less time and less incentive to explore. I think that the same thing is true with scientific research. It has to be much more results focused than, well, let's just see what happens if we go here. I wonder, and this is just something, I wonder, this is part of why people tend to leave their options open, sort of me-ism, you know, picking and choosing, not committing to a single path or to something bigger than ourselves. You know, it might I wonder if it's part of what manifests here at the centre in not booking for activities in advance, not following through on it, or yeah, more widely, not following through on a meeting you've set up with somebody. Wait to see how you feel on the day. Maybe something more attractive might come along in the meantime. You know, sometimes sort of events at the centre have been cancelled because people hadn't said they were going to come, but they've had it in mind and would have turned up on the day. You know, we tend to, these days, to have to run introductory courses as drop-in, because people very rarely feel able to commit to a whole course. Now, obviously, there's often good reasons for people not being able to commit to something before the day. You know, it's like not a blanket statement. And the most recent course we had, with one honourable exception that we knew about, everybody who was there on the first day, whether they booked or not for the whole thing, stayed throughout the course. But that was actually quite unusual. Yeah. I also, the capacity for spontaneity is really important. Not always having to stick to an unalterable timetable. Yeah. Sometimes it's unavoidable, we need to make last minute decisions. But it can have an effect on others. It can have an effect on the wider community. An extension of me-ism, egoism maybe is better, there's what I believe the French refer to as egoism à deux, the romantic ideal. We fall in love, we want a sexual relationship, many of us want children. That's normal and that's human, but it is so heavily promoted in our society, in advertising, clothing, perfume, foods even, to attract a mate, make them happy. And certainly that's the way advertising seems to be targeted at women. I haven't really, that's what I'm aware of. Men might also notice this as well, but it's certainly something I've noticed. You know, fairy tales, Jane Austen, a lot of popular fiction, they're all about finding, you know, your soulmate, the one true person, the one person in the world that could make you complete, as it were. Yeah. And they live happily ever after, to the end of their days, sort of thing. Either spoken or unspoken. It's like, that's, you know, you're just ending the story at a particular point. You know, even today, if you've reached 30 and haven't settled down with someone, you can feel like a failure. Or you were married, you did settle down with somebody, but then something went awry and you got divorced. And then, you know, you might not have found anyone else yet. You might have done all sorts of amazing things with your life, feel very fulfilled in other ways, but because you're not married or have a long-term significant other, you and other people, perhaps your parents or sort of other family or friends, start to worry, feel that something is wrong. And as someone who's been single a long time, I notice often when people talk about we, when they've not specified the other person's name earlier in the conversation. We're going to see my parents this weekend. We're redecorating the kitchen. It's not usually talking about them and a good friend. It's their partner. It's an automatic identification of oneself and one's partner as a single item. Yeah, egoism à deux. It's very understandable. It's one of the ways we look for security, that there is someone that loves us. And also, speaking as somebody who's been long-term single, it's very easy to assume that the grass is always greener on the other side of the marriage bed, as it were. Obviously, that's not always the case. One of the issues, I think, with the romantic ideal in our society is that it's a tendency to put all our emotional eggs into the one basket. The relationship, capital R, has to carry a lot of weight, which might otherwise have been held by extended family or a wider network of friends. You know, who do we go to with our deepest secrets? Who do we open up to most? Who do we turn to when things go wrong? One of the joys of the movement is that people can and do develop strong, non-romantic friendships. I'm not trying to say we shouldn't have relationships. I'm not trying to say that and I'm certainly not trying to say that relationships with other Buddhists are automatically better or stronger or longer lasting than those with non-Buddhists. How would you tell?
Yeah.
But they can be held within a bigger context. So maybe, and it is just a maybe, they're not so fragile or fraught with expectations. Hopefully, they could become more positive and less sense of isolation within the relationship. Moving on. There's an app for it. Looking for quick fixes from the outside. Materialism, consumerism, possessions, food, chocolate, alcohol, cigarettes, etc. will make you feel better. Last weekend I went to see the film Trolls with my sister and my nieces. It's great fun, it's a sweet little film, very, very, very well-meaning. And the sort of the baddies in the film were these Borgans who are just perpetually miserable. And their way of seeking happiness would be to eat these very happy trolls. they're sort of little sort of bouncy, sort of multicoloured creatures. I'll say more about them later. If they ate these trolls, they would feel happy, and it was the only thing in the world that would make them feel happy, they believed. That was the story. So it's that thing about appropriating something or someone from outside to make oneself feel better, rather than practice, if you like, cultivation of positive mental states from the inside, just working with conditions as they are. Linked in with that, superficiality, distraction, triviality, what Amarugosha tends to call needing to always be constantly plugged into the matrix. constantly available to answer phone calls, texts, emails and so on, always being on call, no downtime from work or other people, there's a sort of inability to relax or switch off, maybe checking your phone when you're having a conversation with someone or when you're in a film. Not actually being present with the person or situation you're in, whatever you're experiencing in the here and now. There might be such as fear of boredom, TV reading, TV watching, net surfing, to cut off from your experience rather than staying with it. It's like we advertise and we encourage people to go on residential retreats, Rivendell, Taraloka, Padmaloka, wherever. And it used to be that sort of retreats were a chance to get away from all that. You'd encourage, back in the day, in the sort of pre-connected days, you wouldn't have a mobile phone, you wouldn't have a tablet or whatever. There'd be a number that people could call if there was an emergency, but that was it. You were, as it were, just there with your experience, whatever was going on. On meditation retreats, always used to be. I'm not sure whether it happens now, but you were always encouraged. Not even to read books, just give yourselves the opportunities to just be present with what's going on without that superficializing distraction and taking you away from what and exploring whatever your experience actually is. These days, people have got mobile phones, tablets, and so on, and seem to be finding it harder and harder and harder to turn them off and just sort of stay with the retreat. Now, you're expected to be constantly available. It has been known, I have heard of sort of retreat leaders even posting to Facebook when they've been on retreat. Yes. Let alone participants. Yeah. I think the two people I'm thinking of have changed their ways. It's been pointed out to them that there's a slight sort of mismatch there. But it's just people want to be connected. And also, it's like mobile phones can be really handy. If I'm out and about in town and I've arranged to meet somebody, it can be really handy if I know that if I'm getting lost or they know that they're going to be in late, there's a way of getting in touch with people, so you're not just standing around like a lemon, sort of not quite sure what you're doing. But, you know, and they're great, they're handy. And there's a downside. Next one. To be busy, to be, when you've got that too much to do, can be a sign of being successful. Sometimes it's worn as a badge of pride. You know, we try to cram in too much into our lives. I guess just sort of thinking, comparing that with, say, the sort of Tibetan tradition where people would go on solitary retreat for a year, 3 years, 9 years, 12 years, and just spend all their time on retreat, as it were, just not doing anything, supposedly, but it's still seen as something of great value and great worth. And often, things, change. Well, obviously, go on retreat for a weekend, you can experience changes. Go on retreat for a year or three, there's the possibility of profound changes happening. And it was taken as a sort of worthwhile thing to do. And people that did it were treated with respect. Another one, possibly a bit of a bugbear about of mine, so it's a personal bias showing here. You have to be extroverted to be happy. Or if you're happy, it's about being with people. Coming back to the Trolls film, these little creatures, they were happy. And their way of expressing happiness was sort of like, child relevant raves, you could say, or dancing, singing, group hugs on the every half hour, on the half hour. The little beepers would go off and say, "Oh, group hug time!" What about the one who wants to be quiet or still or reflective? In the film, it's like the one character who's obviously had a it's very sad, and he's very grumpy and suspicious, and his colouring is grey and sort of rather than sort of vibrant pinks and purples and whatever. And he's unpopular, and he's like, "Oh no, you're just miserable. Go away." It's like, "You don't want," but it's like, "Come and have a hug." It's like, "No." obviously it's a slight exaggeration, but you see that in wider society. It's like, to be happy, you have to be happy in a particular way, or do it in be sociable and drinking, partying, whatever it is, rather than sort of quiet pleasures. Another one, cynicism, not being idealistic or not having ideals. Traditionally, we have a historical culture of deference to authority. It's great that famous people aren't put on pedestals so much. Human beings, if you put somebody on a pedestal, you'll see their feet of clay, possibly their legs of clay, hips of clay, But because particularly thanks to modern media, we know all about their flaws. leave it. because we know about their flaws, we dismiss their positive aspects. Everything that they've accomplished that is truly worthy. We do need heroes. We need people to look up to, people we can emulate, that can embody an aspect of an ideal for us, while still, on the human level, not being perfect. Somebody who's very generous or very kind or very wise, is a very good communicator. It's like, maybe cynicism comes from a fear of being let down, but we need to have a sort of mature relationship with whatever or whoever we encounter. Not expect perfection from imperfect beings, but also have the ability to be open-hearted and respond wholeheartedly to what is positive. And then coming sort of linked with that again, egalitarianism. Every life is precious and valuable. So to me, egalitarianism is more about denying that some people are better than others at some things. that some people are wiser or more spiritually developed. It denies the possibility of individual growth and development. So, you know, for me, the Buddha was different to the other wandering mendicants in ancient India. You know, he was not just one path or teacher among many. We need heroes. We need to be able to aspire to become something better and something different. Now then, I'm aware that I haven't spoken about many positive aspects of our modern Western society. You know, we do have a strong cultural tradition, arts and the sciences. We've got a stable democracy. You know, people, whether democracy is inherently better for the Dharma than, say, a benign dictatorship, I'm not saying. But it's like people do feel able to speak up and challenge the status quo, which does have a very, very positive aspect. But what we have in the three jewels, in the Buddha, the Dharma and the spiritual community, the Sangha, is precious and it's to be protected and cherished. It's very different to what's out there. You know, we need to, you know, it's great that the Buddha's teaching is becoming better known and can have a positive influence on what's going on in the world. You know, so what Sangha actually used to talk about in terms of the new society. It's important to make sure that what we teach is relevant to what's going on in people's lives and changing circumstances, but also just asking questions about, you know, how we actually practice.